lucharé por colaboraré. Es easy, you la la.
Vamos a ver pa' matore. Vamos a ver pa' matore. Vamos a ver pa' matore. Vamos a ver pa' matore.
Hello and welcome to Your Homegrown Food. I'm your host, Wander Fox, and you are listening to 101.1 FM in Santa Cruz and freakradio.org on the internet. This is a show about all things food. The aspect of food that most interests me is the food movement, which is about changing our food systems so that we produce and consume healthier food. There is more to it than that, which is why last week I read an article by Michael Pollan called The Food Movement Rising. I didn't get through the whole article on last week's show, so I'll finish the last page today. When we left off, Michael Pollan was talking about Carlo Petrini, the founder of the slow food movement. Okay, here we go. Ever the Italian, Petrini puts pleasure at the center of his politics, which might explain why slow food is not always taken as seriously as it deserves to be. For why shouldn't pleasure figure in the politics of the food movement? Good food is potentially one of the most democratic pleasures a society can offer, and is one of those subjects, like sports, that people can talk about across lines of class, ethnicity, and race. The fact that the most humane and most environmentally sustainable choices frequently turn out to be the most delicious choices, as chefs such as Alice Waters and Dan Barber have pointed out, is a fortuitous, to say the least. It is also a welcome challenge to the more dismal choices typically posed by environmentalism, which most of the time is asking us to give up things we like. As Alice Waters has often said, it was not politics or ecology that brought her to organic agriculture, but rather the desire to discover a certain taste, one she had experienced as an exchange student in France. Of course, democratizing such tastes, which under current policies tend to be more expensive, is the hard part and must eventually lead the movement back to more conventional politics, lest it be tagged as elitist. But the movement's interest in such seemingly mundane matters as taste and the other textures of everyday life is also one of its great strengths. Part of the movement's critique of industrial food is that, with the rise of fast food and the collapse of everyday cooking, it has damaged family life and community by undermining the institution of the shared meal. Sad as it may be to bowl alone, eating alone can be sadder still, not least because it is eroding the civility on which our political culture depends. That is the argument made by Jeanette Flaming, a political scientist, in a provocative new book called The Taste for Civilization, Food Politics and Civil Society. Significant social and political costs have resulted from fast food and convenience foods, she writes. Grazing and snacking instead of sitting down for leisurely meals, watching television during meal times instead of conversing, 40% of Americans watch television during meals, viewing food as fuel rather than sustenance, discarding family recipes and food ways, and denying that eating has social and political dimensions. The cultural constructions of capitalism, its tendency to undermine the stabilizing social forms it depends on, are on vivid display at the modern American dinner table. In a challenge to second-wave feminists who urged women to get out of the kitchen, Flaming suggests that by denigrating food work, everything involved in putting meals on the family table, we have unthinkingly wrecked one of the Nurseries of Democracy, the family meal. It is at the temporary democracy of the table that children learn the art of conversation and acquire the habits of civility, sharing, listening, taking turns, navigating differences, arguing without offending, and it is these habits that are lost when we eat alone and on the run. Civility is not needed when one is by oneself. These arguments resonated during the Senate debate over health care reform when the New York Times reported that the private Senate dining room, where senators of both parties used to break bread together, stood empty. Fleming attributes some of the loss of civility in Washington to the aftermath of the 94 Republican Revolution, when Newt Gingrich, the new Speaker of the House, urged his freshman legislators not to move their families to Washington. Members now returned to their districts every weekend, sacrificing opportunities for socializing across party lines, and in the process, the reservoirs of good will replenished at dinner parties. It is much harder to vilify someone with whom you have shared a meal. Fleming makes a convincing case for the centrality of food work and shared meals, much along the lines laid down by Carlo Petrini and Alice Waters, but with more historical perspective and theoretical rigor. A scholar of the women's movement, she suggests that American women are having second thoughts about having left the kitchen. However, the answer is not for them simply to return to it, at least not alone, but rather for everyone, men, women, and children, to go back to the kitchen, as in pre-industrial days, and for the workplace to lessen its time demand on people. Fleming points out that the historical priority of the American labor movement has been to fight for money, while the European labor movement has fought for time, which she suggests may have been the wiser choice. At the very least, this is a debate worth having, and it begins by taking food issues much more seriously than we have taken them. Fleming suggests that the invisibility of these issues until recently owes to the identification of food work with women and the related fact that eating, by its very nature, falls on the wrong side of the mind-body dualism. Food is apprehended through the senses of touch, smell, and taste, she points out, which rank lower on the hierarchy of senses than sight and hearing, which are typically thought to give rise to knowledge. In most of philosophy, religion, and literature, food is associated with body, animal, female, and appetite, things civilized men have sought to overcome with reason and knowledge, much to our loss. But food is invisible no longer, and in light of the mounting costs we've incurred by ignoring it, it is likely to demand much more of our attention in the future. As eaters, parents, and citizens, it is only a matter of time before politicians seize on the power of the food issue, which, besides being increasingly urgent, is also almost primal. Indeed, is the same deep sense proto-political. For where do all politics begin, if not in the high chair, at the fateful moment when mother or father rises a spoonful of food to the lips of the baby who clamps shut her mouth, shakes her head no, and for the very first time in life awakens to and asserts her sovereign power. All right, I guess I have a call. Let's see, how do I answer the phone? I've never done this before. Let's see. What line is ringing? 37 on. You're on the air. Let's see. I have no idea how to do this. Hello? Sorry, I don't know how to take a call on the air. I've never had one before. Maybe if you call back, I can try to, let's see. Oh, oops. Are you there? Take it off mute, maybe? Are you there, caller? Huh. Sorry, I don't know how to take a call on the air. Maybe if you call back, I'll figure it out. In the meantime, I'm going to go on to the next thing I was going to read. Let's see. I have another article that I wanted to read last week and obviously didn't get to. So, let's see. This is from San Francisco Chronicle, and it's called Alice Waters' Push for Local Organic Setting National Agenda. Alice Waters is a pretty famous chef. Most people have heard of her, I think. She has a restaurant in Berkeley, I believe. So, food crusader Alice Waters is making the rounds to promote her new cookbook. McDonald's, she told Bill Maher on his TV show Real Time, is never the answer, not even for impoverished families trying to put food on the table. Then, in her signature breathy voice, she lambasted the microwave. That's not cooking, Waters said, somewhat flustered that Mayer would even ask about the common kitchen appliance. I don't know how to relate to it. I need a little fire. Last week on Martha Stewart's program, she tried to impress the importance of learning how to chop an onion, peel garlic, and make chicken stock. Food bloggers responded with their usual snark. Waters appears on Mayer's show was cringeworthy, wrote Grub Street, San Francisco, going on to describe her performance on Martha as loopy when she roasted an egg on a giant iron spoon in her kitchen fireplace during an earlier 60 Minutes interview. You could almost hear the nation gagging. Yet despite the scorn she sometimes evokes, Waters is steadfast. Her message is hitting its mark. For nearly 40 years, St. Alice, as she's been called, for her unrepentant views, has touted the importance of eating local, organically grown food, emphasized the necessity of being good stewards of the land, and tirelessly advocated and funded nutritional meal programs in public schools. For many of those years, she was mostly ignored, seen as a Berkeley radical whose ideals were not only elitist and unrealistic, but also a bit wacky. But as Americans began grappling with an obesity crisis and journalists and documentarians began exposing the ills of factory farming, Waters' little movement motored away from the fringes and into the mainstream. First lady on board, Michelle Obama, wasted no time in planting an edible garden, some believe at the urging of Waters, on the south lawn of the White House. Obama's Let's Move campaign, which replaced her predecessor's literacy drive, addresses much of what Waters has been preaching. Celebrity chef Jamie Oliver's Food Revolution on ABC TV has taken Waters' message to prime time. Even former President Bill Clinton, famous for his love of Big Macs, has taken up the cause, combining forces with the American Heart Association to form the Alliance for a Healthier Generation. Alice and people like her, along with my own weight and heart problems, inspired me to take on the issue of childhood obesity, Clinton wrote in an email. The former president says he met with Waters while dining at her restaurant, Chez Panisse, where the activist supposedly tried to talk him out of blueberry ice cream in favor of a perfect peach and has read her books. I know how passionate Alice is about fresh food and the importance of Americans living healthier lives, he wrote. This helped inspire Clinton to work with the soda companies to wean students off high-calorie soft drinks and to help schools improve their meals and exercise programs. The First Lady's leadership on this issue will make a big difference, he added, and Alice's involvement encourages even more success. Thrilled with progress, Waters, 66, couldn't be happier with the momentum. I feel empowered, she says, while sipping mint tea at her Chez Panisse cafe upstairs from the restaurant that inspired the Farm to Fork movement and will celebrate its 40th birthday next year. And perhaps she feels a bit vindicated. I always knew it had to happen, she says. I just didn't know it would happen so soon. These are not my ideas, she continued, a bit teary-eyed. It's the way people have been eating for hundreds of years. Still, Chris Lehane, a political consultant who has worked with Al Gore and Bill Clinton, sees water as the George Washington of the movement and Northern California as the 13 colonies. If you're going to pick a figure who's responsible for it all comes back to her, says Lehane, adding that even 10 years ago, food probably wouldn't have crossed a politician's mind as a public policy issue. Not unless you include Ronald Reagan calling ketchup a vegetable, he laughs. But now, Lehane says, people don't see the campaign as more of those San Francisco values. This has become a health issue, even in the red states. About 32% of children and adolescents today are obese or overweight, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Being overweight is a health risk that can lead to type 2 diabetes, heart disease, depression, and other life-threatening illnesses. It's a problem that Waters says has reached emergency levels. In 1996, she created the Chepanese Foundation, a nonprofit that, along with the Berkeley Unified School District, pioneered one of the most ambitious and lauded school food programs in the country. First, they planted an edible garden at Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School that became a model for the rest of the nation. Then they hired renowned school chef Ann Cooper, who made every dish from scratch and bought all the produce from local farms, organic whenever possible, starting a movement. A.G. Kawamura, California Secretary of Food and Agriculture, says he first met Waters at the edible garden 5 years ago. Since then, nearly 4,000 children have been planted. 4,000 gardens have been planted at California schools. When we saw how Alice had linked the garden to the cafeteria, a culinary institute, so to speak, we were amazed, he says. It was a great concept that could be duplicated everywhere, but her contributions haven't stopped at the school cafeteria. Waters, who was recently awarded the French Legion of Honor for her efforts to promote slow food, a movement designed to combat fast food, has been a boon to small farms and the local food shed. 2 years ago, she helped organize the first American Slow Food Nation, a four-day political food festival in San Francisco that featured local growers, chefs, and nutrition experts. She has helped to reintroduce the public to where their food comes from, Kawamura says. What's really remarkable is that she has been consistent with her message, even if people don't agree with it. And a lot of people don't, partly because she's rarely willing to compromise. In her new book, In the Green Kitchen, Techniques to Learn by Heart, that's her new cookbook. Waters hopes to get Americans back to the stove. I'm trying to demystify cooking, she says. I'm trying to talk about universal and basic techniques so that once you know them, you can cook anything. So, if she manages to teach her readers how to whip up a scramble, will it be enough, even if the eggs were bought at Safeway? No, she says. I want to know where everything comes from, continues Water, who buys her groceries straight from California farms. I don't want to have to choose between local and organic. I want both. I don't want to live a half-good life. That's where her message can start to bug people. It's making the task of getting Americans to eat more fruits and vegetables unachievable, says James McWilliams, a food historian at Texas State University. It's a great example of the perfect being the enemy of the good. McWilliams, who warns against food primitivism, says Waters' message involves a certain amount of privilege. There is a kind of elitism about it, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, he says. If you have the time and the resources to support the local food shed, that's great. But there are some who see her as having boutique concerns that are out of touch with where our food worries should be, like how we're going to globally produce 70% more food in the next 40 to 50 years. School chef Cooper, who has left Berkeley Unified to start a similar lunch program in Boulder, Colorado, and across the country, says her mentor has certainly been a target for the naysayers. When her effort to launch organic lunches at Berkeley High School didn't work. It made the New York Times in a particularly ugly, nasty way, she remembers. Then there was the Atlantic piece that criticized her Berkeley program. People just seem to like to pick on her. Maybe it's because they perceive her as just a little too precious. But in the face of intense adversity, she's been unwavering. The seemingly unflappable Waters has big plans for the future. Tops on her agenda is overhauling the USDA's National School Lunch Program. She's already started by lobbying for the federal agency to more than double its budget to feed America's youth, which would include ridding the cafeteria of processed foods such as chicken nuggets and syrup-drenched fruit. If she has her way, schools would serve more fruits and vegetables bought from nearby growers who use sustainable and organic farming methods. I'm trying to focus my energy on the people who can win this race, Waters says, and there are so many doors that are open right now. Okay, there's a bunch of recipes after this article, and if you'd like to check it out, I have a link to this article on my Facebook page, which is Your Homegrown Food Show on my Facebook page. So check that out. I also have a link to the other article that I read by Michael Pollan. I have a link to that article on my Facebook page. And next I wanted to say that I think that a big part of the food movement is people producing their own food. And I'm a constant advocate for homegrown food. And now is the perfect time to get started producing your own food if you don't already. Growing food in your yard or in containers on your porch is a fabulous way to produce an abundance of food for yourself. Another way to have some of your own homegrown food is to keep bees for honey. Haha. The other reason to keep bees is for their pollination services. Many food crops are dependent on bees to produce. If you're interested in keeping bees and you live in the Santa Cruz area, then the best way to get started is to attend the Santa Cruz Bee Guild meetings. And there happens to be one tonight. It starts at 6:30, and it is in the El Rio Mobile Home Park meeting room, which is at the end of Pacific Ave. It's 2120 North Pacific Ave, where Pacific Avenue and River Street cross in downtown Santa Cruz. And tonight's meeting will be about bees and plants. Which plants provide pollen and nectar, and which plants you should plant for your bees if you're going to have bees. And the Santa Cruz Bee Guild meets every month on the first Wednesday in the El Rio Mobile Home Park meeting room. So I highly recommend going to the Bee Guild meetings because they are free. And I'm sure that many of you have heard about colony collapse, which is a big issue these days. All of the honeybees are disappearing at an alarming rate. And so if you want to do your part to try to slow that down or stop it, getting a beehive seems like a good way to do that. So you can go to the Santa Cruz Bee Guild meeting and find out how you can get your own beehive. 'Cause making your own honey, or owning bees that make honey for you, I should say, seems like a good idea. It's a good way to make some food for yourself. So I highly recommend going to the Santa Cruz Bee Guild meeting if you live in the Santa Cruz area. It sounds like a really great community of people, and they'd be happy to get you started. And if you'd like more information about the Santa Cruz Bee Guild, you can find a link to their website on my Facebook page, which I mentioned earlier, which is, if you go to Facebook, go to Your Homegrown Food Show, and I have a link up there. You can check that out, and you can get more information about anything I talk about on this show, or if you'd like to leave me a message and tell me something you'd like me to talk about on the show, or if you'd like to be a guest on my show, or if you would like to suggest a song about food that I could play on the show, or anything about having to do with food, or if you'd like to know about what I do, you can also go to my website, which is yourhomegrownfood.com, and you can leave me a message on my Facebook page, or you can send me an email at yourhomegrownfood@gmail.com. And I think that's all I have to say for today. I am ending a few minutes early, but that's okay because I went over on time last week. Anyway, yeah, you can tune into Your Homegrown Food every Wednesday at 11:30, from 11:30 to 12. I'm here talking about all things food, and you are tuned into 101.1 FM and freakradio.org. We are here in Santa Cruz. And if you'd like to make a donation to our station, because this is a completely volunteer-run station, dependent on programmers' donations and donations from listeners, you can make a donation by sending it to FRSC 7811, that's P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Or you can go to freakradio.org and you can make a PayPal donation there. And we really appreciate your donations because we are a completely volunteer-run station. We do not have any advertising or underwriting or anything like that. We don't get any money from any sources other than donations, so we would appreciate your donations. And check out our website, freakradio.org, and make a donation there, or look at our program schedule. If you'd like to have a show, it's a pretty easy process. You can get your own show on our station, which I think would be a really cool thing. We'd like more local programmers, so find out more information about that on the website, and stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up next, and come back by next Wednesday at 11:30 to hear the next installment of Your Homegrown Food. And I've been your host, Wander Fox, and have a great day.
And be sure to tune in.